and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the weaponization of conspiracy theories and cynical propaganda that has flourished and is encouraged by Donald Trump, who continually refers to the mainstream press as fake news, while often citing hideous and sick lies manufactured by Alex Jones and others on the fringes of media and sanity. David Carroll, a professor of media design at the New School, who researches and analyzes major shifts in the media as it relates to privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism, joins us to discuss how YouTube has had to take down scurrilous videos it had been hosting, which claim one of the Florida students who survived the recent massacre is a crisis actor. We'll look into information pollution that is deliberately manufactured to further political ends and discredit a genuine reaction to a social crisis and an American tragedy, which right-wing operatives are defiling by claiming an outspoken student survivor, David Hogg, is an actor, quote, bought and paid for by CNN and George Soros. We will also explore whether the decline in public education and the lack of critical thinking contribute to why Americans appear to be susceptible to such disgusting lies as Alex Jones's claim that the massacre of kindergarten kids at Sandy Hook was a government false flag operation. Then we'll speak with a 23-year former member of the CIA's clandestine service who retired as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats about the extent to which Putin and the Russians have penetrated not just the United States' political and electoral systems, but the White House itself. Glenn Carl, the author of The Interrogator and Education, joins us to discuss his concern that not only does Putin appear to own Trump, he might even be reading the top secret PDB, the president's daily brief. Then finally, we will assess whether Donald Trump's answer to the latest school massacre to not just arm teachers, but to pay them a bonus for packing concealed weapons, is something he truly believes or is an NRA talking point. John Donahue III, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis, joins us to discuss the contrast between the passion, clarity, and conviction of the young victims who met with the president in the Oval Office and the solution offered by the nation's leader, which is to give a bounty and firearms training to those charged with educating our kids, along with a license to kill them. And joining us now, David Carroll, who's a professor of media design at the New School and director of its Design and Technology MFA program, which explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. His research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Carroll.
Great to be here. Thank you, Ian.
And it's extraordinary to have watched this horrible tragedy down in Florida and then seen these extraordinary young high school kids step forth and really change the political debate in this country. And even some of them even showed up in the White House, hosted by President Trump, where they were extremely eloquent and powerful. And yet out there in social media, on YouTube, for example, one of the main speakers on behalf of these students, who is a student, of course, himself, and a survivor of the horrible massacre at his own high school, has been labeled as a crisis actor, which is a new term in itself. So I'm wondering about us as a society. Is there something happening here in the broader sense that we are becoming a less educated, a less critical thinking is going on in our educational system? How could it be that so many people believe such incredible nonsense, but they believe it with passion and certainty?
Yes, it's been disturbing to watch sort of conspiracism increasingly envelope the discourse, and in this case, it's reached sort of new depths by creating this notion of a crisis actor, which originates in really the far extremes of conspiracy theory purveyors, as this idea that everything is a performance being staged for the benefit of a conspiracy against the right wing, and this idea that nothing is what it seems, and a secret cabal is choreographing everything that people see, and it is absurd and ridiculous to entertain these ideas. Obviously, anyone who has ever run an organization themselves knows that it would be impossible to control every bit of it, even if you could entertain these ideas. But what's been really disturbing is to see these brave young people who really stick their neck out and put themselves at personal risk speaking out about these important issues, and then, you know, that many people don't have the decency to even respect them for, even if they disagree with the content of their arguments, to not sort of give them the decency of being a victim of this attack. And it really shows the new lows that we have reached as a country in aligning with hyper-partisan filter bubbles and echo chambers where an alternate narrative can be concocted and people accept it without challenge, and only need the most spurious of almost, you know, falsified evidence to buy into these ideas. The platforms like YouTube and Instagram and Facebook, et cetera, they don't help. They make it worse by creating a extremely effective platform to disseminate and promote this stuff. And when people see it in this context, it amplifies their tendency to buy into it. And the platforms themselves are showing a strong resistance to taking responsibility for the misinformation, disinformation, hoaxes, character assassinations that are not only being distributed on these platforms, but that they perform exceedingly well in terms of reaching trending interfaces where then they're the thing that gets promoted. And we get stuck in this self-fulfilling prophecy with these hoaxes that the minute they sort of become, they surge in popularity, they are then surfaced as the popular piece of content that then more people click on. And the minute something goes into the trending interface, it amplifies and it exacerbates even the position that it has in people's field of view. And so it really goes to show the problem of optimizing content for people to engage with it as opposed to optimizing content for its reliability.
And again, I'm speaking with David Carroll, who's a professor of media design at the New School and director of its Design and Technology MFA program, which explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. His research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. So, David, it does seem, though, in the political context, that what's happening here is that opposition research and dirty tricks have become mainstreamed and acceptable. I know Putin developed this through his political technologist, Surkov, the idea everything is possible and nothing is true, that you just throw out all kinds of contradictory information to keep everybody off guard so that they don't really know what's happening. And meanwhile, of course, Putin and his buddies are stealing the country blind. And you have a similar situation here, it would seem, you've got a guy called Mike Cernovich who just makes up all kinds of insane right-wing stories on a daily basis. And Vice News interviewed him and said, you know, how can you do this? And he said, well, it could be true. So that seems to, there's absolutely no moral grounding in any of this stuff anymore. And that the fact that this very articulate young man, David Hogg, whose friends were murdered before his eyes at his high school, has been called an actor would indicate to me, and of course they say that he's bought and paid for by CNN and George Soros. Again, these are political buzzwords for discrediting anything or imagining this kind of left-wing conspiracy that they all believe is so real. So the sense that I get is that you can't dissociate this kind of fake news, which is what it really is, from a political desire to basically, I mean, in effect, it goes back to, remember what happened with John Kerry, who was a war hero from Vietnam? And what did Karl Rove and his cohorts do? They took away the best asset he had as a candidate running for president, which was against a guy who didn't serve in Vietnam, which was that he was a war hero. And they took it away by coming up with this phony group of people called Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. And they absolutely shredded Kerry's war record, and it was very effective. So if this is what's going on here, that these young people are being very effective at waking up the American people about the need for gun control, then what do? These guys on the right, they take away that advantage.
Certainly. I think we have seen the escalation of tactics into the realm of partisan warfare, political warfare, information warfare, however you want to describe it, but the rules of engagement for politics have changed over the past few election cycles in particular, as you noted, and it's gotten more extreme, not less so, and technology has amplified and enabled these tactics to become even more weaponized in terms of being able to mount these attacks from sort of grassroots origins and then amplify them, and then influential voices in these movements can be very effective at endorsing ideas. And then and certainly when politicians themselves endorse these ideas, then they become almost unstoppable in terms of the way that they spread through these separate information spaces. So, yeah, in many ways, the entire controversy over the, you know, continually disputed election results of 2016 revolve around information warfare and political warfare and the use of technology and data in ways that is really unprecedented, and weaponizing media and social media in particular ways. I think it's all connected and all part of the sort of same systemic shift that we're seeing towards a more extreme willingness to engage in really hostile attacks on people with really very little regard for truth and justice in many ways. So it's very disturbing. And these general attacks on the free press and the use of kind of dog whistles, attacking George Soros, is a kind of double dog whistle, because it certainly implies an anti-Semitic aspect to it, which is very disturbing to consider, and then also, is a strange attack on billionaire who funds political activities, when we see on the right side of the political spectrum the same issue of wealthy individuals, oligarchs from America and Russia alike, funding political activities at an unprecedented scope and scale. So all these factors together are what we're trying to make sense of in trying to survive a new kind of political atmosphere. The good news is that the young, courageous students from Parkland, who are very eloquent and brave in speaking up, they've grown up in this social media environment. They've come of age in this sort of harsher, more extreme environment. And so the hope is that it's not a new thing to them. They've grown up with it, and they may have some newfound survival skills to rise above the fray and make sure that their voices are heard and not drowned out and not discredited.
Well, to be fair, though, it's not just on the right that they believe crazy stuff and propagate crazy stuff and hateful, hurtful stuff, like what Alex Jones does. I mean, Alex Jones also has a following on the left as well. He was behind that movie that first developed the kind of truther movement about 9/11 being an inside job. And in fact, our sister station in New York, WBAI, is having a special in a few days' time on chemtrails, which is another lunatic conspiracy theory. And the person who puts it on is one of these believers in that Sandy Hook, the massacre of those young kindergarten kids, was a false flag job conducted by the U.S. government to take away your guns, which is one of Alex Jones's theories. So is there a place where the loony left and the loony right meet? Again, it gets back to my sense is that there's something changed in this country, because it wasn't that long ago that most Americans believed what Uncle Walter Cronkite was saying on the evening news was real. And nowadays, and of course we have a president who propagates the idea that the mainstream media propagates fake news and therefore the alternative media tells the truth. Well, I'm asking you too many questions because I'm frankly pretty disgusted by this whole situation. So take those questions as you wish.
Sure. So yes, the susceptibility to fall prey to hoaxes and misinformation is somewhat equal opportunity across the political spectrum. So we can certainly observe that no political view or ideology is completely immune from these susceptibilities, and it comes down to just our natural human trait of so-called confirmation bias, where we look for evidence to support our views and tend not to look for evidence to contradict it. But the research shows that the appetite for misinformation and disinformation on the right of the political spectrum is significantly more voracious than on the left. The volume and sort of scale of this kind of content is consumed at a higher rate on the right. When some recent political science research has been conducted to figure out what are the patterns here. So there is a, you know, so like sort of is equal opportunity in the broad sense. And if we look at the Kremlin-affiliated Internet Research Agency, which came out of the Mueller indictment, we see in patterns there an equal opportunity tactic to just divide the country up based on its existing divisions and to exacerbate the divisions and chaos in the country, to not necessarily focus on one slice of the electorate or they were certainly targeting states. They were targeting so-called purple states where the chance of dividing the population could have an effect. But this idea, yes, that why is the idea of a common narrative, there's a diminished ability of a common truth to emerge, especially through journalism. But the good news is, if we can think of some good news here, is if we look back on a recent report published by the PR agency Edelman called their Trust Barometer, which they conduct a significant survey globally and have for a couple of decades now. So it's a useful measure of trust across industries over time in certain places. This past year in 2017, while the trust in media fell significantly and is the sort of least trusted of the industries measured, if the data is split apart and we look at the difference between trust in platforms versus trust in journalism, we see an interesting split in the past year's survey, where in the United States, the trust in platforms fell 11%, and the trust in journalism actually increased 11%. So an interesting even split there. And so when people are surveyed and they are able to distinguish between, you know, do they trust what's on Facebook and what's on YouTube and what's on Twitter and Google and so on as a platform, actually people are losing trust in that. And gaining trust in the practice of journalism. And so from some measures, journalism is having a golden moment. Subscriptions are increasing at the major papers. And so even though it seems like doom and gloom, that is a bright spot. And it also shows that the platforms have a business imperative to solve some of the problems, because if trust continues to erode, their bottom line business will be harmed.
Well, of course, that is the ultimate difference, I think, between conspiracy and journalism. That the senator, on one hand, once said people are entitled to their own opinions, but not to their own facts, and that journalism is really about not so much what you think, but what you can prove. And obviously people in the alternative right-wing and left-wing world of conspiracy feel empowered to broadcast what they think as opposed to what they can prove, and that has muddied the waters. But just personally, I have to do a little bit of clarification here, and this is to do with real journalism, where they go wrong. And the point is, if the Associated Press got stories wrong every day, they'd be out of business. And when they do get something wrong, they retract it. And a couple of days ago, I interviewed a reporter from Newsweek who had put out this story about how an alt-right bot network took down Al Franken, and now Newsweek has retracted that story. So I have to, since I interviewed this journalist with Newsweek, I have to retract it as well, at least alert our audience to the fact that Newsweek has retracted its story about, I'm quoting from Newsweek, a conservative botnet effort to force the resignation of Senator Al Franken. The initial report was based on research conducted by Unhack the Vote, a group examining outside influence in U.S. elections and politics. It alleged that a decidedly alt-right botnet weaponized anti-Franken stories and amplified pressure on Franken to resign after allegations of sexual misconduct. Newsweek was unable to independently verify their claims after further review of their work. Newsweek regrets the error. So that's the difference, isn't it? That in real journalism, if you get something wrong, you have to retract it right away because you're in the business of trying to be accurate and building trust. In the conspiracy world, it doesn't matter. Alex Jones never apologizes, least of all to the parents of the kids who lost their children at Sandy Hook.
Yes. And this is the big difference between a media company like a journalistic outfit like a newspaper or a magazine that has a responsibility to its readers and to the society that it serves. And this is a major difference between the platforms that don't consider themselves media corporations. They consider themselves some other category so that they don't have to uphold the same kind of integrity and responsibility to maintain the trust of the audiences. Many people think this is because of the what's called Section 230 of the Communication Decency Act, which essentially grants broad immunity to platforms that simply disseminate data rather than produce it. And so the platforms like YouTube, Google, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, they consider themselves under this Section 230 consideration as why they are reluctant to perform any editorial judgment, because once they start exercising editorial judgment, they would probably lose their immunity under Section 230. So I think there really is a legal dynamic at play here, and it's causing unintended consequences, because certainly if the platforms employed human editors that were willing to, for example, more aggressively prevent disinformation, misinformation, hoaxes from getting the reach that they do, where they reach, you know, tens, millions, hundreds of millions of people, and if they took responsibility for that, I think it would have a net positive effect on the sort of information pollution that is occurring at a massive scale now and is sort of degrading the discourse. Many people trace this back to a single clause in the Communication Decency Act, and that remains an open legal question as how much longer can the platforms maintain this immunity? and how much pressure is going to be put on them to exercise the editorial judgment required to maintain the civil discourse required here.
Well, David Carroll, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Carroll, who's a professor of media design at the New School and director of its Design and Technology MFA program, which explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. His research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a former 23-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine services about whether or not Putin doesn't just own Trump, but he might even be reading the top secret president's daily brief.
That you find a pretty face can hide an evil mind. Oh, be careful what you say, or you'll give yourself away. Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Glenn Carl, the author of The Interrogator and Education. He was a member of the CIA's clandestine services for 23 years and retired in 2007 as the Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Glenn Carl.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Glenn. And what do you make of following the latest indictments by Robert Mueller, the president's response, and there's another associate of Paul Manafort's has pled guilty. But there's a sense that Donald Trump is on a roll here. The Republicans becoming more and more accepting of him. Even people like Senator Corker, who were critical, are now apparently sort of sucking up to him. I don't understand why he's suddenly being enabled in this way with not just loyalty, but with respect by critics within his own party. But when you look at some of the stuff that's going on, particularly with the Chief of Staff, General Kelly, trying to figure out how to deal with the fact that there are 130 senior White House staffers without proper clearances, security clearances, including the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, you have to ask yourself, with all the accumulated evidence coming out about Russia's involvement in the elections and the unbelievable inability of Donald Trump to say a bad word about Vladimir Putin and to ignore the majority, the 99% majority of the House and Senate wanting to sanction Russia, and Trump is not doing that. And you get the impression that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's not completely off the wall to suggest that this government has been thoroughly penetrated by Putin, as Clapper, the former director of national intelligence, the top American intelligence officer, said, for all intents and purposes, Vladimir Putin is Donald Trump's case officer. So if that's the case, then don't you think that Putin, as an intelligence officer, has penetrated the White House and maybe he's even reading the presidential daily brief?
Well, it's hard to know where to begin. There are so many profoundly alarming and dangerous developments in our political life and in our government and in our society. For over 2 years from, probably 8 months before any public statements, maybe 7 months before any public statements were made by any journalist or individual about the activities of Russian intelligence toward and with members of the Trump entourage, Trump campaign, and possibly Trump himself. 7-8 months before that became public, I have been trying to say exactly that. I tried to contact colleagues of mine who still are in the government. I tried to talk to journalists about this. Now, I don't have firsthand information. I am a retired officer. But for an intelligence officer, watching public affairs and watching Donald Trump and knowing how the Russian intelligence services work and how they target and penetrate targets in, of interest in the United States, it just jumps out at anybody how vulnerable Trump is, how clear Russian activities are. And then we have found, unfortunately, that that perception has been progressively established in fact, over and over and over, point after point, from source after source, demonstrates that Russian intelligence of multiple sorts, multiple ways, have targeted and have worked with, exploited members of Trump's entourage, Trump's family, Trump's business, and probably Trump himself. It's just absolutely clear. And that is shocking. So to concisely answer your question, if the Russians have not penetrated the White House, I would be flabbergasted because I know how to conduct intelligence operations. And with this many signs and this many vulnerabilities, you'd have to be incompetent not to be able to exploit them to your own advantage.
And what do you think happened in that meeting that took place recently with the head of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, who's a very partisan Tea Party Republican, very close to Trump. Apparently Trump likes him. And he met, along with Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, met with the heads of the three major Russian intelligence agencies, the SVR, Foreign Intelligence, GRU, Military Intelligence, and FSB, their equivalent of the FBI. And nothing was said about it. What was said about it was absolutely absurd, that it was all about, you know, dealing with terrorism. Nobody believes that. And then, so it's hard not to wonder what is still going on there. I mean, there's never been a normal president would have, once it became public, his own Justice Department is telling the world that the Russians meddled in our elections. Any normal president would go to the public and say, this is unacceptable, we've all been attacked, and we've got to figure out a way to prevent further attacks. Instead, Trump is shouting from the rooftop to somehow he's been vindicated, because the latest indictments didn't mention White House collusion or the Trump campaign collusion. So none of what he's doing makes any sense, and I don't know what his own director of Central Intelligence is doing, meeting with the very same Russians who, without suggesting in any way escalating tensions, but at least you should put these people on notice that, you know, what you did is unacceptable and we're not going to take it anymore.
Well, a charitable interpretation of the meetings would be that there are reasons, and it is not unusual for Russian intelligence officers and American ones at senior levels to meet to discuss areas of mutual concern, to deconflict, to cooperate, and so on. That is true. But it is also true, as an intelligence officer, that you always conduct intelligence operations with a cover story and a totally plausible and probably true series of explanations and reasons. The best lie is the truth. It's just not the right truth. So yes, it's true that I went to the movies, sir. But the real reason I went to the movies, unstated, might be that I was there to meet a spy. But you know, I went to watch 101 Dalmatians. That's how you conduct an intelligence operation. So I am not saying that Pompeo and the rest of the national security leadership are Russian spies. But I am saying that no intelligence officer acts altruistically. You always seek what's called net advantage. You only meet if you assess in advance that you can derive more benefit from the meeting than you will give to the other side. So that's what the Russians are doing. Now, what are they doing? Yeah, let's look at Pompeo for a second. Pompeo is a Tea Partier who, although quite impressive, you know, first in his class at West Point, obviously very bright, spent a lot of time cutting his teeth on the Benghazi investigations, which were, you know, there are 500 separate investigations with a collective of, you know, 400,000 man years of testimony or some unbelievable thing for many, many millions of dollars. And it was all a transparent sham just to bring down Hillary Clinton. There was never anything to the Benghazi story whatsoever. That's quite clear. Now, I was not at Benghazi myself at the time. However, you can see, yes, Americans were tragically killed. The circumstances are disturbing. So obviously, things went wrong from how Americans would like them to go. From there to say that Hillary was polishing her nails and was willfully accepting the death of people or whatever it was they were alleged, you know, is obscene and was proven by themselves to have no foundation. And yet, he continues to maintain that. It's equivalent to the whole birther garbage that Donald Trump used. So the fact that he is meeting with the Russians and then says, here's the reason why, I wouldn't believe what he has to say for 2 seconds. I think the Russians are there because they are trying to coordinate their, pursue their own objectives, of course, and to do so with willing parties. And Trump's administration wants to meet with the Russians. And so the Russians will probably try to either feed information or obtain information by questioning and shape perceptions within the community. And that's what the Russians are up to. What the Americans are up to, I suspect, Trump has told his senior deputies to make nice to the Russians.
And again, I'm speaking with Glenn Carl, the author of The Interrogator and Education. He was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. And what's your sense then of whether or not something is going on, a macro deal? Because my understanding is that what Putin is doing, first of all, the anti-American propaganda suddenly has been switched off and it's been very intense. And as you know, Putin is running for president yet again, and he's basically running against the West. That's his main platform, to distract the Russian people from the wholesale theft of their country by Putin and his cronies. They keep pumping up this specter of NATO and the West being responsible for all Russia's problems. But so that's been dialed down. It looks like Prigozhin, his buddy, the cook, who was behind this recent, or was in this recent Mueller indictment for the troll factory that he runs in St. Petersburg, Prigozhin also runs these mercenary armies that fight for Russia in Ukraine and in Syria. And most of the Russian mercenaries there in one Prigozhin's guise were wiped out in a recent battle where they marched on the Americans, which was insane. Mm-hmm. They did it without air cover, which would suggest that the Russian military hung them out to dry, and they were slaughtered. So I don't know what's going on. Do you have any inkling?
Well, I don't. I would suspect that the Russians got ahead of themselves there and then found themselves up against people who just wiped them, Americans who just wiped them out. And that wasn't part of the Russian plan. I think that you're maybe underestimating Putin, certainly a kleptocrat, and he's the 21st century Romanov kind of thing, and is happy to have an oligarchy like this with him on top. But he is a nationalist and a patriot, and is pursuing Russian national interests, which are pretty traditional ones, and he's doing so very successfully. So what I think is going on in the larger sense is a lot of the Russians, no one ever has as coherent a strategy and grand master scheme as we all imagine. People respond to the circumstances of the moment and then do things ad hoc and are in contradiction with themselves, and one agency works across purposes or other. All that the Russians suffer from, at least as much as anybody. However, they do have, I think, quite clearly strategic objectives, which they are pursuing coherently and with great success. And they are, and Donald Trump is either their willing ally in this or their unwitting useful idiot in this. And the two things are adding up to the same. And both could be partially true simultaneously. And the Russian objectives are that what is bad for America is good for Russia. So they define it. So let's cut America down a notch in any way. We will foment discord, disaffection with our political system, distrust of institutions, arguments, weakening of the ability of the American government to act coherently. We will separate the United States from Europe. We will weaken NATO. We will weaken the European Union. We will extend and reassert Russian control of the near abroad, they call it, which is essentially the Central Europe or the countries of the Warsaw Pact. What have we seen? They have seized the Crimea. They have done what they want in Georgia. They've done what they want in Azerbaijan. They have they are pressuring the Baltics. They have strengthened the military capabilities within Kaliningrad, the Russian enclave. They have fostered discontent with democracy in Ukraine. They are separating Poland and Hungary from Western norms. All of this they are doing with the frank acceptance strategically and agreement and assistance of Trump. Those are strategic aims that they are pursuing, and they are achieving them with Trump's help.
But Trump's either owned by Putin, and that explains why he can't ever say anything against him or do anything against him. That seems to be one interpretation. But those that give Trump the benefit of the doubt say, well, he's really trying to, you know, restore a kind of detente because we can't afford to have a nuclear war with Russia, you know, all that stuff. So if Putin is sacrificing Prigozhin, my sense is that maybe there's a deal there. Maybe Putin is basically, because his own chief of staff, Sergei Ivanov, who was a KGB general, very much a superior of Putin's. And even though, as you say, Putin's a nationalist and he's pursuing Russia's interests, he was never a very successful KGB guy. So he sort of gave deference to Ivanov. But then Ivanov had warned him, Putin, that this meddling in the American election was a terrible idea and there'd be blowback. And Ivanov lost the argument to Peskov, this PR guy that now is very much Putin's right-hand man. So they fired Ivanov and they went ahead with this project. And you could argue that it's been a catastrophe for the Russians. It certainly hasn't gotten rid of the sanctions that apparently General Flynn promised them that they'd get rid of the sanctions. And in fact, they've doubled down, even though Trump himself has held off on implementing them. So is it possible?
Well, you pursue. Yeah, I mean, you know, but you pursue everything that you want to pursue and while trying to prioritize and in the expectation that sometimes the opponents will, you know, they get some wins also. But why not try to advance all of your pieces and so long as you have a overall strategy? I don't find it inconsistent at all with Russian objectives. And one wouldn't expect, if you have a penetration in a foreign government, a source, an asset, we call it in the CIA, that person is committing treason for you against their country. But the person also works within a larger framework that he or she cannot control and will have to, and probably sincerely will want to, take actions that are not that are against your own interests. The person running the spy. But you accept that as part of what is required to maintain the source in place and to have influence. You don't expect that. No one's going to be a complete automaton and just become the Kremlin in the White House. You do what you can do, and then you work against your master's interests sometimes because you have to, working in the system that you're trying to change. I didn't articulate it as well as I should, but it's not surprising that someone who is an asset of a foreign power take actions against that foreign power sometimes while continuing to work for the foreign power. Well, it's right out of Sun Tzu, frankly. That's you know, the art of war from 3,000 years ago. This is one of the basic rules of espionage.
Right, but that was what I was suggesting, is that maybe Putin and Trump are secretly working on a deal where Putin can get out from under the American election meddling operation that's backfired by hanging Prigozhin out to dry and saying it was an independent operation. And Trump can get out from under Mueller if he can make a deal with Putin, and they can both say, look, this did happen, but it wasn't authorized, and we're all terribly sorry, and we're all going to work together for world peace.
Well, I never expect Trump to say that. I think that's being too clever by half a little bit. I don't know. The closest I've come to your interpretation just then is I've started to see. I have old friends, which is sort of amazing to me, but I have old friends who are in the Trump entourage, let's say, friends who go back many, many years. And a couple of weeks ago, they started to say to me, look how hostile Trump has been to Russia. You can't say that he's in the Russia's pocket. Now, we just recently started to hear Sarah Huckabee Sanders adopt this line. But all smoke and mirrors, and they point to tertiary steps, whereas the strategic ones are the actions that Trump has taken or not taken are deeply in Russia's strategic interests and not those of the United States, you know, undermining NATO, separating us from Europe, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's how I would have started to see what I think you're getting at, which is a way for Trump to try to show, no, you know, I'm not what you guys think. Your assessment, I don't know. Maybe, but I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Well, Glenn Card, let's stay in touch as this extraordinary situation continues. I think.
Well, I've said for 2 years, the United States is confronting the gravest crisis to our institutions and country since 1861. And people have thought that I'm priggish and engaging in hyperbole, but I think that I'm spot on.
And that's because of Trump, right?
Because of Trump and because of Russian actions and because of the threat to our democracy by one major party that seems to be repudiating democratic norms.
Well, Glenn Card, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Glenn Card, who's the author of The Interrogator and Education. He was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into Trump's answers to the latest school massacre, which is to not just arm teachers, but to pay them a bonus for packing concealed weapons.
Does it easy? Does it? They got something to say.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is John J. Donahue III, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He has written numerous publications on gun control policy and is the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Donahue.
Hello, good to be with you.
Well, thank you, John. And the president, to his credit, invited a number of the student survivors from the Florida gun massacre last week at the school in high school in Florida, and some parents from Sandy Hook and parents of who'd lost their children in the Florida latest gun massacre in a school. But he did suggest, there was a tremendous contrast, I thought, between what the students were saying, the survivors were saying, and the parents who lost their kids were saying, which was with enormous clarity and conviction and passion. And in contrast, the president didn't appear to be that empathetic, although he was obviously trying and he had some notes in his hand about what to say. But what he brought to the table was the idea that the best way to solve this problem is to arm teachers. And the people in the Oval Office, the visitors, did not think that was a good idea. But since the Oval Office meeting, Trump has doubled down on it on two more occasions. And now he's actually calling for teachers not just to be armed, but to offer them bonuses for being trained to carry concealed weapons. So what's going on here? Is the president, does he really believe that? Does he really believe that the answer to this problem is to arm teachers, or is he just offering up NRA talking points?
Well, hard to know, although I did hear some of the commentary, and it suggested that his plan would, you know, solve the problem just like that. And that suggested to me that it really hasn't been thought through very carefully. This is a sort of NRA position to sort of turn mass shootings into opportunities to perhaps expand gun rights. And more broadly, the evidence suggests that when citizens are allowed to carry concealed handguns, it does lead to an increase in violent crime rather than a reduction. So one has to take this, very carefully as one thinks about it, because in the populace at large, more guns has led to more crime, and one would wonder what is going to be different about this idea about putting guns into the school. I can't believe for a minute that it would allow just any parent or teacher to carry a concealed handgun if they could get a permit. That would be a truly horrific idea. And maybe he has some idea of, sort of specially trained individuals that makes them closer to a police officer or an actually security personnel. But the details are critically important here because, one of the avenues by which permit holders contribute to gun crimes is that their guns are stolen on a very frequent basis, and the last thing we want is to have some teacher's gun stolen in a school setting and starting off a catastrophe as opposed to reducing a catastrophe.
Well, the head of the NRA spoke today at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., in Maryland, and basically said that the elites and the socialists were hell-bent on undermining America's constitutional rights, saying that they hate the NRA, they hate the Second Amendment, they hate individual freedom. So that's where he's coming from, and obviously all of their suggestions are all about selling more guns and more ammunition, because that's what their job is. They're the lobby for the gun manufacturers and the ammunition manufacturers. And in that regard, they do a hell of a good job. But do you think that there's something happening in this country that's stirring here? I know every time there's a massacre, there's outrage, but then nothing gets done, and that leads to a lot of demoralization. But a lot of people are encouraged by the extraordinary clarity and intelligence and passion of these young students down in Florida.
Yeah, well, certainly there has been an increase in energy, although I do recall there was quite an energetic response in the few months after the Sandy Hook shooting. So what will be required is a more sustained effort. The passions of Americans are frequently inflamed for a short period of time, but the steadiness of the NRA is a constant, so it's going to be interesting to see. I do think, though, that the NRA comment about freedom are just so misplaced. What law is all about is developing the wise constraints that do make men free. And we don't have freedom if everyone is free to have massive military weapons at their disposal. So clearly, more legal restrictions are necessary to promote the freedom of all American citizens. I should also note that one of the things that the NRA has been pushing for and the Republican Congress has shown great sympathy for is the idea of getting rid of silencers. And I'm sure criminals all across the country would be delighted by that, but one can also imagine you make your mass shooting problem that much worse if your shooter is walking through the halls with a silencer on top of everything else. So the NRA record of pushing for things that are likely to make us safer is very poor, so I would be very cautious about looking to any statement that they made before I embraced it.
Well, the NRA are trying to, be less aggressive and more user-friendly. They're pretty pin-up model that their spokesman went to the CNN town hall, although the students were not impressed with her. But I don't understand why the gun control people, or the gun safety people, as they prefer to call themselves now, can't somehow get through to the public that this all this business about the Second Amendment is so distorted. I know the Heller case turned it on its head. The amendment's predicate says that a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, a citizen's right to bear arms shouldn't be infringed. Now, the cart is now before the horse, where the citizen's right to bear arms is the important part, not the well-regulated militia, or the important part, which I think is, which being necessary for the security of a free state. At this point in America, we, the citizens, can argue that we are no longer secure and no longer free in the streets of our own country, in the malls of our own country, in the schools of our own country, and in the churches of our own country. And this is all because a handful of people want unlimited gun rights.
Yeah, it's there are many troubling elements here, and you mentioned the very controversial 5-4 decision of the Supreme Court in 2008 that has made things more difficult here in California. The voters overwhelmingly approved the very, very sensible ban on high-capacity magazines, but the gun interests have managed to get a federal judge to enjoin that ban, and I'm hoping that the will of the people will be able to, you know, prevail in that legal dispute. But I'm concerned about the U.S. Supreme Court. Trump's initial appointment, Justice Gorsuch, is an extreme and fanatical advocate supporting the Second Amendment. So that's a troubling development.
Well, just in closing, though, is there a possibility of a shift rather than be buffaloed by this minority, the tyranny of the minority? There are only 5 million members, and I know there are more guns than there are people in this country, but we're the only country in the world that has this problem, and it recurs every other day, it seems. And at some point or other, there just has to be some kind of critical understanding in the zeitgeist, and my feeling is that these kids are telling us that this is enough already. So yeah. What's your sense, just in closing, of whether we've passed a Rubicon or yet another Rubicon?
Yeah. I mean, I've been saying for some time that the problem will get so bad at some point it will be addressed. I'm hoping that this is the moment. But I also thought Las Vegas might be that moment and Sandy Hook might have been that moment. But the problem of mass shootings is statistically getting worse and deadlier. So we either will address the problem now and reduce some of the mayhem, or we'll wait until the calls for change become deafening at some point.
Well, John Donahue, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Good to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with John Donahue, who is a professor of law at Stanford Law School and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's written numerous publications on gun control policy and is the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.